going to read one verse this morning, Canto 3, chapter 29, text number 37. I'm going to read the Sanskrit because it plays an integral part in the meaning of the verse and message of the verse, and for that matter, the whole chapter. Rupa bedas padam devyam kala itya vidhiyate bhutanam mahad adinam yad bhina drisham yat yato bhina drisham bhayam. Translation, the time factor. Kala means time. So the time factor. It's interesting how Prabhupada takes terms like bhakti, which is normally conventionally translated as devotion, and he adds devotional service. And kala means time, but he consistently is the time factor. It helps make the meaning clear, because we'll see from the verse. The time factor must be seen connected with what's at the other end of the stick. That's the Supreme Lord. It's His stick. It's His energy. And His energy is doing something, but we should not see His energy separate from Him. That's what the verse is saying. The time factor, which causes the transformation of various material manifestations, is another feature of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Anyone who does not know that time is the same Supreme Personality is afraid of the time factor. Purport, everyone is afraid of the activities of time, but a devotee who knows that the time factor is another representation or manifestation of the Supreme Personality Godhead has nothing to fear from the influence of time. The phrase, the first line of the verse, rupa bedaspadam. Word for word, it's divided into two parts. Rupa beda, we know what rupa means, means form. And beda, B-H-E-D-A, means different. So that of the transformation of forms, aspadam, the cause. The transformation of forms has a cause, and that's the time energy, and the time energy has a relationship of non-difference, abhinna, and with the Supreme Lord, and to see they're different. You know, matter and the forces that control matter are different from the Supreme Lord. Has fear. That's what the verse is saying. The phrase rupa bedaspadam is very significant. By the influence of time, so many forms are changing. For example, when a child is born, his form is small. But in the course of time, that form changes into a larger form, the body of a boy, and then the body of a young man. Similarly, everything is changed and transformed by the time factor, or by the indirect control of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Usually, we do not see any difference between the body of a child and the body of a boy or a young man, because we know that these changes are due to the action of the time factor. That is the cause. There is a cause for fear for a person who does not know how time acts. So, I thought I would spend time with three different things to help with this verse. Start with the last line, Yato Binadrisham Bayam. Binadrisham. From Bhagavad Gita, this is a Bhagavad Gita quiz question. Where does the word bina appear in Bhagavad Gita? Bina. Huh?
Seventh chapter.
Say the whole verse. Ahankar ityame bina prakritir ashtada. So that's the last line. Bina prakritir ashtada. Ashtada, there's eight. There's eight bina prakriti, separated energies. Bina prakriti. So there's Krishna, because two verses later Krishna says they're both under my control. But they're called bina prakritir, separated. And it's for a theist or for an atheist, there's no, like we heard last night, I don't know if you noticed that the comment from over there, those two ladies, some people, the New Age people, like your question, they don't see. They don't wish to see. They wish to not see that there's a source of things. And then with that source of things, sanctions things. They don't like that. They have to acknowledge, there's somebody up there and I have to, I'm answerable to them. I'm accountable to somebody. They don't like that. They want to see things happen without that sanction. Now, Vyasadeva's teaching throughout this chapter, this is Kapiladeva's teaching, but Vyasadeva is compiling it, is one who doesn't see that. The language that Prabhupada uses to translate this bina is, he calls the separatist. In modern language, that has a bad connotation. In Vedic teachings, it also has a bad connotation. not the same way, but one is certain to be in la-la land, in illusion. You can't see what's what. Or, to see what's what, there has to be this sambandha again, that is, our standard understanding of what sambandha is, there's a source, and there's a relationship of all things with the source. Everything has a source. And the whole of Vedanta, which is the summation of all the Vedas, it starts with, what's that source? Atato, attaha, now that you've received this human form of life, we have the faculty to ask the question, where does everything come from? It's in the Vedas, it's in life. Here's two examples. It's in life. When Lord Brahma was born on the lotus, growing from the navel of Garbhadakshaya Vishnu, what was the first thing that came to his mind? I'm hungry. Where did I come from? And with that is, who am I? Because where did I come from tells something about who am I. If we understand where I come from, we have a really good idea about who am I. Or conversely, if you don't understand where you came from, you don't have a good idea of who you are. So, and he did what he did. He climbed down the stem. He used his reasoning faculty, anuman, logic and reason, well, I'm sitting at a lotus and there's a stem that the lotus comes from, so I just follow the stem, I'll find where I came from. Very logical. But by logic, he couldn't find where he came from. Because you can't. Down and down and down and down. And so there was another method to find out where he came from. Then a second example is, who knows how many millions and billions and quadrillions and whatever the, you know, other sums of money have been spent by tax funds and investment funds to find, to answer that question. You know, where, how did everything begin? And how many brains and how many hours and research and speculation and writing and why? There's like a geneticist might say, well, you just have a gene to ask that question. But whatever the reason is, it's a natural question. People ask that question. If you don't ask that question, you're brain dead. So where does everything come from? Well, then different teachings say different things. We just discussed it yesterday. Some say it's just atoms. Some say it's karma. Some say, you know, what's God? So they may not like the word God, but, you know, where does everything come from? Big Bang. And on and on. And evolution. And well, where did that matter come from? The laws that govern matter. Don't ask that question. It's just primordial. That's God. And on and on and on, and I know theoretical physics and biology and philosophy, and where did everything come from? So Vedanta Darshan is, there is a source where everything comes from. And in this chapter, because it's, you know, explanation of devotional service is the chapter, six times he uses slightly different Sanskrit language, Kapila Dev, to say the same thing, you know, that lower stages of consciousness, covered consciousness, is when you see things separate. And the application, I'll go through them one by one. The application is diverse. Sometimes it's, you know, how you see other living entities. Sometimes it's how you see matter. In this case, it's how you see time. That's the cause that transforms matter. Or whatever the application, seeing things separate from their source, oneness becomes covered, and in the covered state, a natural condition is fear. So they can make a bumper sticker or, you know, a decal that says, no fear. It's a bluff. Macho bluff. Because on the platform of the soul, that sense of being disconnected, it's a fearful condition. Or the converse, the natural condition, the natural sense of fearlessness is where we're protected. But if you don't have any shelter, then you have to fight. So it's, you know, survival of the fittest, and someone's going to come along and eat me, or someone's going to come along and beat me, or someone's going to come along and, you know, knock my apple cart over or something. You know, like these, it's just the one of the modern applications of this is what's going on in the news with these mass killings, and people are, they're being interviewed. Yeah, I used to feel safe, but now I don't feel safe. Anyway, without elaborating, it's not just the circumstance. If I feel safe, that's also la-la land. Because everything's going to be taken. And when everything is taken, because we're attached to that, whatever it is that's taken, although it doesn't belong to us, it's sure to be taken, then we're setting ourselves up for lamentation and fear of loss. It's just part of material life. So what to do? Because things are temporary, and they're here today and gone tomorrow, or maybe even doesn't not till tomorrow. you're now a transcendentalist. This doesn't seem separate, that time energy still takes away the body and all those things that are temporary connected to the body. So then how does a transcendentalist look at that situation like death? Well, Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, the wise don't lament for the living or the dead. Why? Because they know how the time factor works. And the time factor works inexorably. Nothing stops time. What's that saying? About time and tide wait for no man. The tide comes and the tide goes. The clock ticks and it doesn't stop. And as the clock ticks, it's using this verse, you know, commonly we would say it destroys things because that's what Krishna says what time does. But here it's, the time is the cause, aspadam, the cause of the transformation of forms. Rupa, bheda. Okay, that's the material world. Rupa, bheda. That's like this housing project, you know, lots of houses, one by one by one. But what was it once upon a time? Probably a farm. And then, okay, some time passed and now it's a bunch of houses and they're still coming up. Wait a while longer, it's going to be something else. Whatever that something else is. Without so many examples. Here's another one. People that grew up in India and they did their studies abroad and and they go back to their place where they grew up. And it's shocking. It's not the same place anymore. I mean, besides how people dress and behave, just the whole thing looks like what happened. Yeah? Yeah? You know, the nostalgia of what it was like, and you go back and it's not there anymore. Not only the people, but the whole territory is what happened. Time passed. And Rupa Beda Aspadam. Tick, tick. Tick, tick. The modes of nature. The living entity who's endeavoring for happiness. Tick, tick. And things change by the influence of time. So I'm going to go back, just in this one chapter, chapter 29, this word bina, because it's in the verse. Yato bina drisham bhayam. Yato, because of which. Bina drisham, that's in this verse. Bina drisham. Drisham means to see. To see separate the time energy from what's at the other end of the stick. Time energy is moving things. Who is at the other end? Nobody. Just the time energy moving. It's just matter according to the laws of nature. That's all that's going on. There's nobody at the other end of the stick. So proper is the stick, time energy, is using the language in the purport. Twice, Prabhupada says, time factor is another representation or manifestation. So representation, the indication of representation is it's not actually the person. Like, let's say, an ambassador of a country. He's not the country. He's the representative of the country. But he represents the country, so he's the country. Although he's not the country. He's the representative of the country. Or manifestation, you know, if you could just like personify the country, there he goes. So an ambassador is not the personification of the country, but in effect he's like the personification of the country. And so, as Prabhupada says, when the ambassador goes to some country, or, you know, with the system of kings, the king sends somebody, his son or his ministers or something, then if the son or the ministers receive something, it doesn't belong to them, it belongs to the king, it belongs to the country. If they pocket it, you know, They're breaking the law, and there's consequences for that. So the other language that Prabhupada uses, everything is changed and transformed by the time factor or by the indirect control of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So we can think of indirect actually as direct. Because the indirect wouldn't be happening if it wasn't, you know, behind the scene or unseen is that which is releasing his energy, his time energy. Because there are phases of time and you know, cyclical. So when Mahavishnu glances, the time energy is sent with his glance. But you go forward to the 12th canto of the Bhagavatam. If you were the Supreme Lord and you wanted to dissolve the universe, what would you do? Just withdraw the time energy. And the whole thing collapses. What can living entities do without time? Answer, nothing. We can't do anything. We're dependent upon time energy to do anything. Walk across the room, you know, digest your food, say Hari Bol Prabhu, you know, anything. We require time energy to do something. And withdraw the time energy, and all the elements, again, like dominoes, they just, you know, fold back into the subtle, and becomes pradhan again. If you want pradhan to do something, you send time energy. Along with living entities that then have their karma and their desire kind of covering them, and then stuff happens. And then they get transformed, and then it gets collapsed by withdrawal of time. So time is big. Now let me go back to the way that bina is used. So there's, starting with the same chapter, 29, text number 8, Maitreya is speaking to Vidura, explaining what Kapila says to Devahuti. So, Kapila, this is explanation of devotional service. So, Devahuti wants to know, devotional service is pure, but is it possible that devotional service can be mixed with the modes of nature? Yeah. It happens all the time. Although it doesn't contaminate bhakti, it just means people, the jiva, may be influenced by the modes of nature, so they mix their modes with that which is pure. So starting with text 8, devotional service executed by a person who is envious, proud, violent, and angry. Devotional service. And who is a separatist, is considered to be in the mode of darkness. And the Sanskrit in text 8 is bina drik, D-R-K, whose vision is bina. That means they see things, a devotee may see things, or people, entities, you know, animals or trees or life as separate, or, you know, separate from the source. And that's the beginning stage, and it's in the mode of darkness. Then the very next verse, text 9, the worship of deities. We're going to the mode of passion now. The worship of deities in the temple by a separatist with the motive of material enjoyment, fame, and opulence is a devotee in the mode of passion. So in this case, their interest is separate from the interest. It's not, you know, I want fill in the blank. So someone who worships the deity, and I want money, or I want people to recognize me as, you know, you're a nice pujari, or you're an elevated, you know, Brahmin or something or other. I want. That's a separate interest. So the Sanskrit here is pratak bhava. Pratak has a very similar meaning or connotation as bina. Like a standard application of pratak is pratak lakshana. So one of the faculties of the primary faculty of intelligence is discerning one thing from another thing. So that's what they do with IQ tests, without the detailing of it. It's just how good are you at discriminating one thing from another thing? So that's what, as a child grows, they can distinguish the difference between something that goes in the mouth and something that goes on their foot. Before they have that everything goes in the mouth. Doesn't matter. Oh, and then anyway, so distinctions, and then your distinction between the soul and the covering of the soul. Distinction between the soul and the supreme soul. So there's levels of intelligence, ability to discern or discriminate between one thing and another thing. So that's what pratak lakshana means. It's the ability to see the distinctions between one thing and another thing. So when there's pratak bhavam, the implication here is you do devotional service, but your interest, like why you're doing it, is different than the Lord's interest in having you do it. And, you know, and there's many applications. The one that's being pointed to here is one who does deity worship, but their interest is other than the Lord's interest. They want something, they want something, or they want something. They're serving because they want something. Pratak bhava. And that's a separatist, strong language from our, you know, cultural perspective. Then, in the series of verses that just precedes the one that we read this morning, is text 23 from chapter 29. One who offers me respect, but is envious of the bodies of others, and is therefore a separatist, never attains peace of mind because of his inimical behavior towards other living entities. Now it's getting more subtly. If there's envy in the heart, and you know, guess what? Envy is there in the heart. It's one of the six enemies of the conditioned soul. Unless we're pure in consciousness to some degree, greater or lesser degree, that's there. You know, and what's behind that enviousness is our envy of Krishna. Envy of Krishna is Krishna has everything. Envy of a person is somebody has something that's from Krishna that I don't have. So I'm envious of Krishna. Separatist. It gets refined or more subtle, and then. The Sanskrit is bhina darshanaha. Bhina darshana. We know what darshan is. Seeing separately. Envious of other living entities. Or he's specific, it's the bodies of other living entities. You know, the place that the repository, the vessel, gross or subtle, that holds something. A quality or an object, or an ability, or something. Somebody's getting respect, so I become envious that somebody's getting respect, I should get respect. Or whatever it is. And then, text 26. And it's just right behind the one that we're speaking about. Repetition is to help us get a sense of what it means, what pure devotion means. Pure devotion means you don't see separate. Now, we don't become Mayavadis, but we see... Anyway, so here's 26. As the blazing fire of death, I, Kapila Dev speaking to Devahuti, I cause great fear. Why do we experience fear? Because Krishna causes it. It's like, how do we experience faith? Because Krishna inspires faith. He gives it, because there's a source of everything. Conviction, you know, anything. Your socks, whatever it is. There's a cause behind everything. So fear has its cause. He causes fear in the hearts of those who makes the least discrimination between himself and other living entities because of a differential outlook. Karoti is the Sanskrit. He discriminates. And bina drishaha, having a differential outlook. But it's not like, you know, we're supposed to see I am you and you are me and we are all together. We heard that one before. But that's impersonalism. So it's not I am you and you are me. But it has to do with something more ontological. That is, we all have the same source. We're all from the same source. We're all brothers and sisters, or we're all spirit souls having the same father spiritually. You know, biologically we have different mothers and fathers, but the sense of unity amongst the diversity is we have the same source. And if we have the same interest as well as recognize the same source, then we can be connected with Krishna in devotion. Now, others may not be seeing like that, but that's okay. We're responsible for how we see things, not how others see things. You know, don't whine and complain. But out there it's really harsh and people don't see like that and they'll take advantage and all those other yeah buts. The recommendation of Kapila to come to the position of understanding devotional services, we should not see like that. And even whoever makes the least discrimination between himself and other living entities is because of a differential outlook. In short purport, there are bodily differentiations among all varieties of living entities, but a devotee should not distinguish between one living entity and another on such a basis. A devotee's outlook should be that both the soul and the supersoul are equally present in all varieties of living entities. Now, we can see the varieties, and you don't turn off your faculty of intelligence, of discerning one thing from another thing. That's not what it's recommending. But on the spiritual platform, there's spiritual equality. Just like Krishna sees, samaham sarvabhuteshu. So we should also see, samaham sarvabhuteshu. Now there's differences, and we can recognize those differences, and we align ourselves with whatever is our nature and support, you know, the system of differences, of varna and ashram. We do that. But when doing that, we should see the spiritual platform that makes us equal. Is it clear? Then comes this one, time energy. The time factor which causes the transformation of the various material manifestations is another feature of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Anyone who does not know that time is the same Supreme Personality is afraid of the time factor. So now there's this difference and non-difference. That's the next message. And that is, the time energy or time factor is non-different, time I am. And there's a difference. Like when Mahavishnu glances, he sends his time energy, even more specifically, according to Brahma Samhita, Rama Devi. Who's Rama Devi? She's the internal potency of Mahavishnu. Rama Devi, being the internal potency, she knows her master's desire. And what's his desire? Compassion. He wants this Chaya Devi over there. She wants some service. So he wants to give her some service. So Rama Devi knows that because she is his internal potency. So what does she do? She assists him. That's what she does, lovingly. And a subset of her potencies is this eternal time. I mean, where does she get that potency from? From the source of potency. But she has so many sub-potencies to do whatever the Lord requires. Or Icha, he just desires. So what happens is she takes that eternal time energy, transforms it into another kind of time energy, you know, the past, present, and future kind, and sends it with a glance. Zoom, zoom, there you go. And then the time energy contacts Pradhan. And it, along with the living entities, it agitates Pradhan and stuff happens in course of time. One after the next sequentially. And then it just keeps going. You get Michigan. And whatever else is out there. So that time energy is him, non-different than him. More specifically, it's the eternal time energy that's under the care of Rama Devi, his internal potency. So his internal potency is not different from him. The transformation of that eternal time energy is non-different from him, but is different from him. Which sounds like double talk, but it's not. There's a relationship of difference and non-difference with the source of emanation. And one who doesn't see that isn't going to get it right, isn't going to get devotional service right. I read some years ago, I've looked for it since, I can't find it, O.B.L. Kapoor. Does that name mean anything to some of you? O.B.L. Kapoor was a disciple of Bhaktisiddhanta, and he was a scholar. I guess he must have an initiated name, but I just know O.B.L. Kapoor. And he wrote this fantastic description. This clarity was really, really good. About there's Shankaracharya's teachings about, what's the source of everything, and that, you know, it's the qualityless Brahman, which really doesn't satisfy that qualities come from qualityless, etc. He points out, you know, the fallacies of Shankara's teachings. Without all that detail. Then over here, he goes through what each of the four sampradayas say, and like way over here is Madhvacharya that says, Panchabheda. Different, 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 five times. Different. Two. So the emphasis on the difference. And that has its shortcomings. It holds up the position of the Supreme. But then how do things happen? That there's, you know, the difference, non-difference factor is missing. Then way over here, and then there's stuff in between, is the teaching of Ramanujacharya, which is Vishishta Advaita, the relationship of non-difference between the Lord and his Vishishtas. The Vishishta Advaita philosophy is that there's a, there are attributes that are in a relationship of non-difference with the possessor of those attributes. And, so, and they inhere within him. Sometimes they're within him, sometimes he manifests them, sometimes he withdraws them. But there's when he manifests them, there's a relationship of non-difference of those things with him. Vishishta Advaita. Relationship of non-difference of all things, and it's just non-difference. Well, then he becomes responsible for bad stuff. I mean, Sri Vaishnavas have their way of explaining it, but you know why bad stuff happens. But Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's teaching is oneness and difference simultaneously. It's fantastic. It's such a cogent, clear explanation of what the Bhagavatam is teaching, or what the Bhagavatam is teaching is Lord Chaitanya's teachings. So we need to see the non-difference as well as the difference. And so time factor, using Prabhupada's language, or time energy, because that's easy, there's the energetic and the energy, so they're non-different and they're different. Time factor, same. Things move. One who does, so the point is that one who doesn't understand that feels fear. And the state of fearlessness is when you do understand it. You know, you're connected to the Supreme at every moment. Even the material aspects, what to speak of the soul, is eternally connected to the Supreme. Eternally connected to the Supreme. At every fraction of a moment, we're connected to the Supreme. Now, we can acknowledge that or not acknowledge that. That's a matter of consciousness. Where does your consciousness go? You know, it's just like chanting. Which we do every day, hopefully. And are we seeing separate, that you know, the name and the person? If we do, then we're not going to chant attentively, because our attention is going to go to something else. Well, anyway, that's our challenge. That's like the best way to get the Siddhanta of Srimad Bhagavatam lined up, is not just theory, but the practice of chanting the holy name, where attention goes to the holy name, because we're with Krishna. Krishna is very kindly coming to us just by calling his name. He's not different than his name. He's there. You don't even have to call him. He's there. Just say his name. There's no time lag. Okay, he's calling me, or she's calling me. He's there. He's so kind. He's present in his name. And if we're inattentive, we haven't understood the non-difference of him and his name. And if you get, if as you, and the, all of Krishna's potencies are there in each and every one of his name. That's a lot of potency. All of Krishna's potencies. Think about it for a couple seconds. All of Krishna's potencies are there in each and every name, and we're inattentive. What to speak of, you know, carrying out our duties. You're going to be mega inattentive to Krishna. So to get attentive to Krishna when we're doing, we're dealing with the material energy, it starts with how we chant the holy name. And if we, to the degree, that even the slightest sense of difference, Krishna then, from within the heart, he inspires fear. We don't deserve the position of peacefulness, you know, Vaikuntha, where we're in another kingdom. Struggling for peace and happiness. So Prabhupada characterized when he first published the first volume of Srimad Bhagavatam and then advertised in that nice poster, India's message of peace and goodwill. People want peace and they want goodwill. We need that sense of being connected. And so that sound vibration of the Bhagavatam and the process of chanting the holy name, our sadhana, helps us bring ourselves once again to the sense of not being separate, not seeing others separate, through this very sublime message. It's a very powerful message, a very powerful sound vibration. Brings us to a position of fearlessness. There's many things more to say, but I'll end and see if there's any comments and questions. Yes.
Thank you, Maharaj. It seems like today's class was a very extended answer on the Maharaj's question yesterday about the problem, is there a problem with not seeing Krishna as the source of everything? So could your explanation today be the answer to that?
He's taking care of his children. You remind him. Yes?
This is from yesterday. You were talking about...
Morning?
Yesterday night.
Evening, okay.
You're talking about how false ego when it comes in the contact with more goodness, mind comes.
Yeah.
So, keeping that aside, like, what I heard is like, you know, the senses are better than the dull matter. Mind is about the senses. And about the mind is intelligence, kind of like a hierarchical.
Yes. So it would make sense that the motive of goodness would produce the intelligence.
Right. So that's.
And passion would produce the mind.
Mind, yeah.
It's a common question. Thoughtful people commonly ask that question, you should say. Supposing you want to enjoy, just supposing, imagine a life where you want to enjoy. What do you need in order to enjoy? You need material intelligence to sort out the way to get that enjoyment lined up. That's material intelligence. That's the mode of passion. And the mind is reflecting or contemplating. Now, certainly the mind can be influenced by the modes. Regularly, we experience the mind is influenced by the modes. But this is just the elements before they mix. And it's the false ego in contact with the mode of goodness. False ego in contact with the mode of goodness is a reflective faculty. When we're not driven by material intelligence that says, you know, here's how you get your enjoyment, that, you know, if when intelligence becomes elevated and purified, then it's directing the mind. Then that hierarchy that you described takes place. The intelligence says, my dear mind, don't go there. Go here. But in material life, it's the other way around. The senses are jumping up and down saying, I want, I want. And the signal goes to the mind. And then the mind says, intelligence, can you help me out? Sure. I want to get one of those enjoyment things. Sure. I may have to go to college for a few years and study up on it, but, you know, sure enough, I can do it for you. Yes, sir. So the senses are up here, the mind is down here, the intelligence is down there, serving the mind's dictates, which are responding to the senses' demands. It's upside down, material. So right side up is that hierarchy. And that's when, so we start with, we do both. We purify the mind by fixing the mind on something spiritual. The name, the form, the pastimes, teachings. And then the intelligence is purified by studying the sacred message of Bhagavad Gita. The mind becomes purified, intelligence becomes purified, senses become purified by the process of devotional service. We're engaging these faculties, the three of them, along with the soul, in purification. So it's service. So then it gets the hierarchy works right. But the unfolding of the elements is before there's activity where it gets upside down. Just, you know, the element. Reflective discernment towards the objective of getting material happiness, and then, you know, the objects of happiness, sense objects of the different senses. Something, yeah.
I'm not sure if I'm framing this correctly, but like we hear that devotional service is a process of developing love for Krishna.
Devotional services, I'm repeating for the recording purposes. Devotional service is the process
of developing love for Krishna.
Developing love for Krishna.
And by inference, loving relationships with the devotees.
Okay.
Now, when we hear verses like these, some of them, they seem to be very strong.
Yeah, they're strong.
And they seem to, like, especially the part where he was saying, even if someone's doing deity worship, but he's having this...
I didn't say, Kapila said.
where his will is different from the will of the Supreme.
No, it's not doing the deity worship. It's doing the deity worship with the motivation that I want this, that, and the other thing, as opposed to just simply serving the Lord for his pleasure.
So is it to be understood that any fear that we feel in our devotional lives...
There's something behind it. It's a sense of that we have disconnected ourselves, in, you know, notionally at least. We've disconnected ourselves, and that's what's behind the fear. So the remedy for the fear is... pause, go into the mode of goodness, mode, space, and reflect. Well, am I connected? Am I protected or not? And if I recognize I'm protected, then the fear is dissipated. The fear, the root of the fear is a disconnect. An illusionally, illusory disconnect. It's not, or disconnected. Yes.
You mentioned that intelligence means discriminating between one thing to another.
Yes, intelligence is discriminating one thing from another.
But the devotee should see everyone equally.
We should see everyone equally on the spiritual platform. Well, let's take a look at what the mode of goodness is. One of the factors is of the mode of goodness is discernment. We distinguish. On the basis of scripture, we distinguish. Not, you know, not the other kind, not the material kind. As Krishna distinguishes, he, with, you know, some examples, he describes the modes of nature. There's a distinction. And what are the symptoms of one who is moved by this mode or that mode? Krishna is seeing distinctions. At the same time, Krishna is Samaham Sarvabhuteshu. So we should also, we can see distinctions with our intelligence. You know, the ladies are over here and the men are over here. We see if there's, you know, a distinction. But, you know, they're equal and we're equal on the spiritual platform. We make distinctions based on the intelligence. At the same time, we see, we must, to be, you know, properly situated in devotion, we must see with regard and respect equally just the positions are different because of the coverings. So we recognize different coverings, we act according to our covering. And we're respecting those that have different coverings on a fundamental basis while we're acting appropriately. Like the verse, an example. This is another example. Krishna's statement in Bhagavad Gita about Vidya Vinaya Sampane Brahmani Gavya Hastani Shuni Chaiva Sapake Cha. What's the last line? Pandita Samadarshana. So the pandit sees equally Samadarshana, all these different, but he's making distinctions. You see, there's the elephant, there's the dog, there's the dog eater, there's the brahmana. There's distinctions, but he's seeing equally. So seeing equally means on the spiritual platform we see equally. Now the embodiments are different. And Prabhupada, in explaining this verse, says that pundit, when he sees a tiger, he doesn't go and embrace the tiger. He behaves with the tiger appropriately. And he behaves with, you know, etc. While discriminating, while the intelligence is operating, we see distinctions and we act appropriately. We have our varna, we have our ashram, we act appropriately. But, and at the same time, we distinguish between, excuse me, we recognize the sameness on the spiritual platform. So we have to have like a, my language is parallel intelligence. The material intelligence is seeing the differences. The spiritual intelligence is seeing the sameness. And then the seeing of the differences, then we, by scripture, we're guided to act appropriately. And also prompts from Supersoul. How do you deal with this and that and the other thing? You don't go necessarily find a verse in Bhagavad Gita that says how you deal with this and that and the other thing. Life is complex. But principles are there. So guided by the principles of scripture, we act appropriately with material circumstance, all the while remembering our spiritual identity and the spiritual identity and offering respect. We don't have to like the behavior, for example, of something that's repulsive. We don't go and embrace the tiger. Okay? Sure. And spiritual intelligence includes not only the soul, but then with that faculty of discernment, know what's appropriate. We're guided by towards proper activity by principles found in Scripture. That's spiritual intelligence, operating within the material sphere. That's what we're obliged to do, we're being trained to do. You got it right. I'm just adding a little bit. Okay? Sure, I saw there was something else coming.
You said when Vishnu wants to impregnate the world, Ramadevi observed the desire of Vishnu and then took that and her energy she sent to the material world.
Yes. Ramadevi saw the Lord's interest and sent her material, the transformation of the time, eternal time, in another aspect of that eternal time, in terms of relative, past, present, future time. She did that.
So, when impregnates the world with living entities, it means that he is just sending the time energy into the world.
Yeah. And that time energy, or here time factor, either, is not different. There's a relationship of oneness, as in time I am, kalos me. And there's an aspect of difference too. I mean, there's a whole chapter in this third canto, you know, calculation of time by the atom. And that the language is very important. It's and in some places it's the same, in some places it's different, and exactly one and different. Well, actually, step back, and time is eternal, with no past, present, future. But then there's an expansion of that eternal time, or a manifestation of that eternal time, that has this past, present, and future aspect that facilitates the desire of the Lord. That is, the living entities can then have material activities because they want. So he facilitates. And Rama Devi does it for him. She assists him. He doesn't have to do anything.
So how does that karma of the living entities tied up with the time energy and then...
That's another class. It's a big subject. But you know, when the living entities are... When time energy is withdrawn, and then all the living entities, the whole material cosmic manifestation collapses, the elements go back to their undifferentiated state, the living entities are in a state of susupti. Susupti? Deep sleep. So in that susupti, karma is in abeyance or suspended, because karma requires time to move it. There was a question during the University of Michigan program. Someone was saying, you know, why do you have to have God? Why not just karma? Just do good karma. Well, here's an answer. Karma doesn't do anything without the time energy. So the living entities in this susupti state, time is withdrawn, and karma is suspended. And so are the modes of nature. They're inactive. It's all in this pradhan state. And the living entities, similarly, but when the time energy is sent forth along with the living entities, you know, karma gets ramped up again. But karma can't do anything unless there's the sanction of the Supreme Lord. So even the demigods, it's like a whole explanation. There's primordial demigods, and they can't do anything without the Lord providing the means for them to do their duty, their job. There's not demigods within universes, because there aren't even universes yet. These are primordial demigods, and they offer prayers. This is in the Bhagavatam, third canto. They offer prayers to the Lord, help. We can't do we know what you want, but we can't do it. We don't have the capacity. Please give us the intelligence and the means. So he smiles and he does it. He expands himself. Anyway, there's details and details. Living entities are what?
When they are in a deep sleep state.
Yeah. Everything, all the elements include the subtle elements. Mind, intelligence, and false ego. They're in the pradhan, just undifferentiated. Then they differentiate. This is another class. This is a creation class. I don't mind, but you know, it's just, let's stay on topic. Okay. Yes. Okay.
And he talks about the Nitya Siddha and Nitya Bada, two
Nitya Siddha and Nitya Bada.
Like eternally bound and eternally liberated.
Okay, right.
The question I had was like, how can a living entity be eternally bound when the material nature itself is not eternal?
Material nature is eternal. Sometimes manifest, sometimes not manifest. Material nature is co-eternal with Krishna. It's his nature. His nature. Sometimes that, now you, it's manifest and unmanifest, but it's the eternal nature. It's not destroyed, it's withdrawn. It's in another state.
So again, does it mean like susupti state where it's withdrawn?
Well, susupti describes the living entity's consciousness, but side by side with the living entity's consciousness, there is prakriti, and it changes state from mahatattva to pradhan, and then pradhan to mahatattva. The prakriti is eternal. There's just different states of it. There are different nomenclature for those different states of it.
So when a person is eternally bound, means like he's not developing his Krishna consciousness, he's in that susupti stage or eternally.
Well, the language that you're using is not correct. Because the living entity that may be eternally conditioned may not be in susupti state. He's conscious, and there's three states of consciousness. Only one of them is susupti, and then there's two others. So he's in one of those three, that's living entity, and then material nature is manifest, unmanifest, or stages of manifest, unmanifest, depending on the phase of time. So there's there are these five factors. And one doesn't operate independently or without the other. They're all under the control of one, all the other four. It's a long, involved topic. Anything from the lady's side? Yeah.
Guru Maharaj, I've heard you say that in the spiritual world, time is conspicuous by its absence.
Yes. And thus, as in another way of saying the same is eternal time. Mm. Eternal time means time as we know it, time, parentheses, as we know it, is conspicuous by its absence. There's no past, present, and future.
So, in the material world, if there's like a spiritual entity, like I was thinking, ISKCON appears to be subjected to time or influenced by time.
It appears to be, yeah.
But is it?
Well, like Srila Prabhupada, he left his body, so it appears that he is subjected to time. Well, the body certainly was subjected to time, but his consciousness, he, was not subjected to time, and therefore there was no fear.
What was the canto that you mentioned in the beginning that all this is from? this thing on time?
It's third canto,
okay.
Calculation of time by the atom. It's very complicated.
Yes. And I have another question.
Yeah.
You talk about sound vibration.
Yeah.
Is that just referring to the Maha Mantra, or is it something bigger, or is it a whole other class?
No, it's going to be very simple. It's not a whole other class. Sound vibration, the name, Maha Mantra includes the name, and the name, Krishna and the person Krishna are non-different. That's spiritual sound. There are other manifestations of spiritual sound besides name, like the Vedas. That's spiritual sound. It's comes from that, from Krishna. And so that sound vibration that comes from Krishna is spiritual sound. Like Bhagavad Gita, it's Krishna speaking. So it's spiritual sound. Or the Srimad Bhagavatam is sound vibration that comes from Krishna, given to Lord Brahma, then to Narada, and then Narada to Vyasa, and Vyasa to Shukadev, who speaks it. The source is Krishna. And so it's spiritual sound. Even the subject matters may be about things that are temporary, like material nature. But material nature is under Krishna's control, and we should see like that. And so then that message is also spiritual. It's coming from a transcendental source, not man, a fallible human source. Fallible human source is not spiritual sound vibration. Something else? Yes.
You're talking about, say, worshiping the deity, not asking for something. I think I'm more curious. So my question was, sometimes, people acting in the world, maybe they're not asking the deity for something, but they're endeavoring for things in the world. So is that asking the deity for something? Like, is that contamination?
Well, just even how the preamble of, or the premise of your question isn't exactly what Bhagavatam is saying. If someone worships the deity with a motive that's other than for the pleasure of the deity, that's passion. Now, goodness, they also have a desire. They want purification. Transcendence is, they just simply want the pleasure of the Supreme Lord. Say it again. Mode of goodness also has a desire component. I want. And transcendental is love. I want the pleasure of the Supreme Lord. No separate interest. Transcendence is no separate interest. Modes of nature, there's some interest. Desire for purification and thereby worship the deity form of the Lord, that's recommended. It's still on the material. It's still mixed. It's not on the unmixed. So that's one distinction in the premise of your question. Now, I didn't quite follow the rest of your question. You know, so similarly, does it mean that if one has a desire to be an enjoyer of something that they're doing, that means a desire of a separate interest from the deity? Something like that?
Yeah.
Well, someone that has a separate interest may not even be engaged in deity worship. There are people in the world that aren't engaged in deity worship that have a separate interest. Passion. Fruit of activity. And they don't have anything to do with deity worship. In fact, you know, they'd say it's bad, but they, you know, they may still have a separate interest. So be careful when you, if you say it's a devotee, a Hare Krishna devotee, and you know, in our temple we have a deity, or in my home I have a deity, and I'm engaged in fruitive activity, I'm interested in pursuing material happiness through fruitive activities. Is that an interest separate from the deity? Yes. So it's not only when you're physically sitting there with your deity engaged in deity worship, it's the extension of your life over in another sphere. It's, you know, separate interest from the interest of the deity. It's something like, you know, chanting of the holy name. The offenses against the chanting of the holy name is not just when you have your hand in your bead bag and you're chanting the holy name. You're like offending the devotees of the Lord. It's not that, well, it's okay if I offend the devotees of the Lord as long as they don't have my hand in my bead bag. So, you know, the chanting of the holy name extends to other spheres of life besides when we're chanting or when we're doing deity worship. So the answer to your question in that case would be yes. Someone that has deity and is engaged in deity worship, even if it's, you know, on Sunday I go to the temple, then one's life is an extension of that. Deity worship. It's one of the things that is part of my life. I worship the deity. And even if it's casual, meaning, you know, the ritualistic kind of thing that some people do, they come to the temple. You've seen. You've all seen. They come to the temple. They stand before the deity with their folded palms. They put some offering of fruit or grain or something. They put something in the hundi box and off they go. What's the consciousness that that person is carrying when they do that? It's religious. It's what a good person does. You go to the deity, you do these things, and you get some punya, and then you'll prosper. Deity worship. It's not the pujari on the altar, it's someone else. And then they go off and do their fruitive activities. So that's separate interest. But, you know, the religious person, that's devotional service with a motive. Okay? Did that answer your question? Yes?
I just heard that motive goodness means I want purification.
Well, that's one of the brands. There's different besides that one.
Okay, and then you followed by saying transcendence means just want the pleasure of the Lord's pleasure.
Yes.
But I could want purification because ultimately it's going to...
Please Krishna. Yeah. Yes. Yes, that's higher. Okay. Supposing I want purification because I don't like to suffer. Mm-hmm. And I know when my heart is impure, it hurts. I suffer. And I don't like to suffer. I want relief from my suffering.
That's goodness.
That's motive goodness. And it moves closer to I want purification. Mm-hmm. But that's supposing somebody is a transcendentalist. They look upon themselves as fallen, but they're not engaging in devotional service so I can become free from my fallenness. They want simply somehow Krishna accept this service. That's pure.
I was thinking about the preface of the Nectar of Instruction where it's explained that, I mean, Rupa Goswami, he wrote because he wants us all to become Vaishnavas.
He wrote because?
He wants us to become Vaishnavas. He wants everyone to.
Sure. That's a transcendental desire. It's not for himself.
Right. But so, I can't become a Vaishnava if I'm not purified.
You can practice. And in the practicing stage, we in honesty acknowledge, I'm not pure yet. Mm. I'm not at that stage of Rupa Goswami. That's a no-brainer. So then we do sadhana. We practice. We follow in the footsteps of Rupa Goswami. And he gave teachings, here's how you can follow in my footsteps, or Lord Chaitanya's footsteps by his teachings. So we do sadhana. And when doing sadhana, we're not yet pure. We acknowledge we're not yet pure. We want to become pure. We want to... And so there's another, just so we don't get too stuck, another standard of the mode of goodness is I do something because it ought to be done. Like duty. That's mode of goodness. It's not love. It's duty. But, you know, like, you know, why should I not steal? Because you don't steal. Why should I tell the truth? Because you should tell the truth. Mode of goodness. You do because it ought to be done. It's the right thing to do, so I do. It's a value that I've learned, I accept, I do for that reason. It's not out of love, it's mode of goodness. But mode of goodness is a good mode. We don't poo-poo the mode of goodness, but it's not transcendence at the same time. That's this, you know, faculty of intelligence. We're distinguishing one thing from another. Okay? Hare Krishna, Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Thank you.